The Husker Doc Talk podcast is now in its sixth season of being presented by the Remington Trophy. This podcast really is the idea of former Husker Dave Remington, who came to me and said, "Hey, why don't you and Dr. Rob Zadiska do a podcast?" After almost a decade run of hosting Sports Sound Off with Dr. Rob, it seemed like the natural thing to do. Of course, the Remington Trophy is given out annually to college football's best center. The celebration event is January 18th, 2020 at the Rococo Theater in Lincoln. If you haven't attended, it's a must. Right now, you can check out the 2019 Remington Trophy watch list, where for the second year, a center from every conference is on there. Go to RemingtonTrophy.com. The Remington Trophy supports the Boomer Esiason Foundation. The BEF provides financial support to research aimed at finding a cure for cystic fibrosis. Additionally, the foundation works to heighten education and awareness of CF and to provide a better quality of life for those affected by cystic fibrosis. We drink a lot of beer recording this podcast, and our beer comes from Infusion Brewing Company. These guys are passionate about what they brew and really are one of the pioneers of craft brewing in the state. They have two locations in Omaha. I'm at the Benson location a lot. You can also find Infusion Brewing beer in fine retail stores across the state. Ticket Talk is brought to you by Ticket Express. Later during this podcast, Ticket Express owner Chad Carr is going to tell you about a special promotion you will not want to miss. I'll give you a hint. Do you want a shot at free tickets to any Husker home and away game this season? Well, keep listening or go to TicketExpress.com, where the price you see online is the price you pay. There's one thing I know. Husker fans like to wear red, and not just at games, but in the airport, on vacation, a night on the town, you name it. And chances are you buy your big red gear at Husker Hounds. Nobody has a bigger or better selection than Scott Strunk. Scott is a personal friend of mine, and I've watched him grow his business from selling shirts out of the trunk of a car to three locations in the Omaha area. Scott isn't just a businessman, he is a Husker fan. Visit one of his three stores or check everything out online at huskerhounds.com. Husker Max is your 24/7 source for Nebraska news, and we thank them for helping distribute this podcast. They got a really cool series going on right now online, the 50 most significant plays in Husker history. Check it out at huskermax.com. And don't forget, you can always reach me or Dr. Rob with questions or comments. Our email address is doctalksports@gmail.com. Dr. Rob is also on Twitter, and if you follow him, you know he's quite insightful, especially during the season. If you don't follow him, you should, at Doc Talk Sports. This is the Husker Doc Talk Podcast, presented by the Remington Trophy, 2019, Episode 7. Dr. Rob, we have a beer in our hand, and that is so awesome, isn't it?
It's a delicious beer. I like it.
Yeah, I know. We're starting the seventh edition of the 2019 podcast off with an Infusion Brewing Company, Vienna Lager. Now, you said you're not usually a lager guy.
Not normally my first choice.
But this one's not bad.
I like it. So this one, it's a lot crisper. Now, sometimes with the lagers, they can almost have...
I think Budweiser when you think lager, right?
Yeah.
And this is not a Budweiser.
Correct. And it's almost too much of a, almost too much malt.
Yeah.
Well, and this doesn't have that.
Well, the Vienna Lager at Infusion Brewing Company was recently tapped, and this is the description you can get of the Vienna Lager. Crisp, crystal clear, and a slightly malty finish. This lager is the thirst-quenching brew you need as we settle into the dog days of summer. This has an IBU hit of 30 and an alcohol level of 5%. It is crisp. There's nothing. The aftertaste of the malt is just perfect.
It is, and that's the thing I tend not to like about lagers is they tend to have that. I'm fine with a caramel aftertaste, yeah. But sometimes that malt is almost too much in some of them. And this just doesn't really have that. When they say slightly malty, that's it. It's nothing more than that.
This was so cool. I was up in Benson yesterday for Benson Days, and I walk into Infusion Brewing Company as I'm getting our beer, and somebody goes, "Hey, are you Travis?" I'm like, "Yeah." It was actually one of my listeners from my Des Moines radio show who hears me talking about Infusion Brewing Company all the time, and he's like, I just had to stop. We were in town coming back from Colorado. We stopped here specifically because you talk about it, and they got some vanilla bean, which shows you.
And
A,
you were there.
And I was there. So we got the power of podcasting, the power of radio, all wrapped up into one.
Nice.
And people just love beer. You know, speaking of beer, I don't know if we talked about this or not. Did you see where Kansas is going to sell alcohol in its stadium this year?
I did.
Yes. How long till Nebraska does that? Does Tom Osborne have to die before this happens?
I don't think it'd be. I don't think it's going to be a case of that happening. But it's. It, you know, I think Moose has even talked about it, which tells me that the thoughts crossing people's mind. Now they're talking about doing it in a very limited sense,
which is for the rich people in the suites and the club levels.
And that's what they're talking about. But you got it. You kind of got to start somewhere. I mean, you sort of have to. Kind of that, you got to poke holes in the arguments and theories against it little by little, and if you can at least get a foot in the door, you can expand it from there.
I think every school that's done alcohol in the stadiums has not had a problem with it. And I think it prevents binge drinking beforehand.
That, yeah, that's one of the big arguments that a lot of schools have said is they've seen a big reduction in binge drinking.
Well, and you don't let people leave at halftime then, right? You don't get to go back to the parking lot to fill up with liquor and everything else you want. I know you leave at halftime, but I mean, to go to the
during the Riley era, I did. My son and I would go out to, well, yeah, we didn't do that last year much, go out and grill chicken.
Yeah, and that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, just say, okay. You're going to sell alcohol till the start of the fourth quarter. You don't get to leave at halftime. They're going to be $8-9 a pop. You're not going to be binge drinking that because you can only handle so many anyway. And I don't have a problem with that. I don't think it's the big sin that everybody thinks it is. I think the good example of that is the College World Series. The NCAA for years said you cannot drink at NCAA tournament events. And then quietly, slowly, they start allowing beer at the College World Series. You don't hear anything.
Do they do it at March Madness?
Now they do.
Okay,
yes.
So NCAA basketball, yep. You can.
Now,
the tournament games.
The College World Series was like the test. They said, okay, beer goes with baseball probably better than any other sport. And so they did the test runs. And now they do it at NCAA tournament events because they realized it's not that big of a problem. You're, at 9, 10, 11 bucks a beer, you're not going to get sloshed.
I think people do limit it for that reason. There's a cost factor. But I think it does. It keeps people in the stadium. I mean,
yes.
There's been more than a few games I and other friends have gone out at halftime. And we're going to go back out and tailgate at halftime. You know, the binge drinking thing, I think, is a very real argument. Now, I'm not saying I get absolutely sloshed before going to games because
more people get effed up in the parking lot than they would the stadium.
It very true, but most of the games I go to are taking our kids, so
yeah.
I'm not going to get too crazy. But I'd be the first to tell you that when we're tailgating before the games, you have a beer or two. And then they're pretty open on the campus with the whole Red Solo Cup thing.
Yeah, which they should be.
And so you always fill one more into a Red Solo Cup and then walk to the stadium. And as soon as you get within a half block of the stadium, you finish it off, throw the Red Cup in a trash or recycling bin, and then head on into the stadium.
So you
always have one more if you don't have that option inside the stadium.
So my son, of course, as you know, goes to the University of Kansas. I'm going to go to the KU West Virginia game on September 21st. So I'll be able to. I'll let you know. I mean, Kansas is doing it for a number of reasons because they suck and they want to get people in the stadium. But I do think it works. I think more people will go to Kansas.
Yeah,
games.
I don't think there's. I have never. I mean, there's going to be drunk assholes everywhere.
Absolutely.
And I've seen plenty of guys getting hauled out of Memorial Stadium in handcuffs because they were drunk off their ass and got belligerent. It's not like that doesn't happen now and there's not drinking allowed inside the stadium. It's because people come in and they're absolutely plowed by the time they get in the stadium. I think if, just like you said, you're not going to have a bigger problem than you do now. It's not a huge problem right now, but it would probably be less of an issue if you did allow it.
One of my favorite stadiums to visit always was Folsom Field at Colorado because Coors is such a big, big beer out there. And, of course, you remember when they could drink in the stadium, especially the student section. What I remember is as soon as the fourth quarter ended in the press box, they cracked the cooler for the media to write their stories. You had an unlimited amount of Coors Banquet and Coors Light. That was
Seriously?
It was so awesome.
Okay, that rocks. No wonder that was your favorite stadium to go to. Because I'm sitting here thinking, you know, we had those little 5-ounce whiskey bottles bouncing off of our helmets when we're sitting on the sidelines. That was not my favorite stadium.
And I didn't like it from getting from end zone to end zone because you had to go up through the crowd and go, excuse me, carrying a camera. That part sucked. But when you got up in the press box and there's unlimited beer for you, you're like, this is awesome. This is totally awesome.
That is the way to treat the media. There
of course,
you go.
We are drinking Infusion Brewing Company beer, two locations in the Omaha area. You'll see me and Benson quite a bit. You might see Rob and Benson as well. We're drinking the Vienna Lager today. Just go to infusionbrewing.com. That's infusionbrewing.com. Big week as well. Finally, practice gets underway. Fan Day, let's start with Fan Day. It's going to be on Thursday, August 1st, 5:30 to 7:30. What do you think, and I don't think we've talked about this yet.
The you got to buy, what
that's
is it?
That's so stupid.
Buy rights to be able to even have a chance to get Frost's autograph.
Do you like that? I get the no adults. I don't get paying to be part of JV.
It's a pretty good package. I mean, I think it's actually kind of a decent thing. The one thing it does do, however, it ensures that you get that autograph.
Okay.
I mean, it's on the flip side, you're guaranteed to get it. If you didn't have that, it's, hey, line up, and it's the guys who are, sorry for phrasing it this way, literally pitching a tent outside the stadium. Because, I mean, I knew people who were literally camping out. They'd bring a small tent, throw a tent up the night before, so they would literally be that first couple of hundred people in line.
You weren't talking about a euphemism at all?
No, I totally meant it euphemistically as well, but good Lord, there's so many wrong directions we could go with this.
You're right.
Anyway,
you're right.
But yeah, there's guys camping out the night before just so they can be in that first couple hundred people so they have that chance to get Frost's autograph. This is a way, if you really want it, it guarantees you're going to get it.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's a bad thing. It looks bad initially, but on the flip side, if you're one of these people who really, really, I got to get Coach Frost's autograph, do this, your kid's going to get Frost's autograph.
You know, the best thing maybe to do is just go to Husker Hounds and look for a signed poster that Scott has.
Hey, Scott has Coach Frost's autograph.
Yeah, I mean, I know you want to get it signed personally, but I'm telling you, Husker Hounds, I'm sure he's got autographed footballs, posters, pictures. Just go to Husker Hounds and say, hey, Scotty, I'm looking for an autographed item from Scott Frost. Just buy it. Yeah, it's that simple.
I'm just not a big autograph guy. No, I get a few. And part of it is I get asked a lot for, hey, we're having a fundraiser for such and such. Can you help me get something?
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually go to Husker Hounds because Scott has good deals on those white autographed footballs. So I always have a couple of those lying around. And when Dave Remington's in town, guess what sells really well at fundraising auctions? Dave Remington autographed football. Been to some other fundraisers. I've gotten Frost and Tom Osborne's autographs on footballs, which I actually went and got each of my kids a Tom Osborne autographed football. I mean, he personalized in my kids. That was great. But I made sure I got a few of those. But in my mind, I'm sitting here thinking, God, I get asked all the time for fundraising help. There you go. This isn't the kind of thing where I sit around and go, man, if I could get Mo Washington's autograph or Wandale Robinson's autograph, that'd make my year. That'd be the cherry on top of the collection. That's just not my thing.
And I get the idea of protecting Scott because nobody's more excited than the fan base right now. This is the most fevered pitch I've seen a fan base in some time, and I get the protection of
it. And I don't know if
I don't like the money grab. I just don't.
I don't think it's a protection thing.
Well, protection from the fact that you're basically limited. You're not creating a line that's 4 hours long. That's impossible to get to.
There's that. I think the thing that it does though, as well, too, is that there's this disappointment and resentment factor when you have a line that's truly hundreds of people long.
Yeah.
And the first, I don't know, I think last year, I don't remember the numbers at all. But I remember they said it was only something like the first third of the people in line for Frost's autograph actually got it. that at some point people need to, these guys got to go home. They got to go back to work. They got to go watch film. They got to go meet with the players. They got to go out to practice. At some point, you got to shut it off, and you're going to have two-thirds or three-fourths or whatever it was of that line of people that you got to say, hey, it's over. We're shutting it down. And they're now they're pissed at, well, yeah, Scott Frost's a dick and doesn't want to sign my kids' football and things like, I mean, you get people that do think that way. I remember back when I was in school, man, half the football team, our numbers were listed not only in the Lincoln phone book, but there was a student directory. Yeah. Nobody ever thought twice about not listing your name and phone number. I remember after a football game, Trev Alberts walking to the locker room after a football game. He wasn't trying to dodge anybody, but there was a kid there holding out a piece of paper. Trev just didn't see the kid. And walked past this kid, and it was purely a case of, you know, there's 1,000 people lining that walk from the field to the locker room. Trev just didn't see the kid. 2 days later, he gets a phone call from the kid's dad, absolutely ripping a new one.
Are you serious?
Oh, yeah. It really shook Trev up. I mean, he was, one, he was actually truly disappointed for the kid. He felt bad for the kid. I mean, he was trying to tell the kid's dad, hey, I'll give you my address.
Come over right now.
Yeah, send me a stamp self-addressed envelope. I will send you an autograph. No big deal. I would truly hook your kid up. I just didn't see him. And the guy was having none of it. I mean, he just absolutely railed on.
See, that's my problem with fans is that they are fanatics.
But that's exactly. And that's the thing is I think when you have the autograph days, the fan days like this, when you got to turn two-thirds of a line away, man, I guarantee you there's a fair number of those kind of dads, moms, parents, kids even in that line who are truly angry. That they didn't get it. This eliminates that.
Did they have Fan Day when you were a freshman, or when did Fan Days come on?
We had it from day one I was down there. I mean, they would set up they would literally line the field with folding tables, like the long folding tables. Mm-hmm.
I remember that.
Church banquet tables.
Yeah.
the church potluck tables. They would line the entire outside of the field. The players, we would sit on one side, and the fans could literally just circle around and get whoever's autograph they wanted. And we would just sit there and sign autographs nonstop for like 2 hours.
So what was the most odd thing you ever had to sign? Do you ever have to sign a MILF's boobs or anything like that?
Once in a blue moon, somebody would kind of lean in close a little bit, maybe. I can't say I ever, never did it.
Look at that nip slip.
Never did it. You know, most of the... In my experience, including my redshirt year, in the 5 years that I went through that, it was great. Fans were awesome. That they really were. You didn't have the numbers, though, that you have now. And I guess the way I compare it would be like spring football.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in school the whole time, other than maybe the last 2 years, 1 year, 2 years, spring football was one of those things where you maybe had like 14,000 people that would show up for the spring game. And three-fourths of them were co-eds hoping to get that early tan. I mean, that was the joke I always crack about spring football, that most of them weren't even watching the football game. It's hard to call a spring game a football game. It's a scrimmage. If you can kind of liken that to what's happened, it compares well, it correlates well with the Fan Day type of scenario. You had a lot of people that showed up on Fan Day to get those autographs, but it's nothing like it is now. I mean, now that you have 80, 90,000 people showing up for a spring football game, you've got the same corresponding increase in numbers of people showing up for the Fan Days as well, too. So it's a lot bigger deal now. When I went there, you kind of felt like everybody who wanted, hey, I need this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy, and this guy's autograph, you got all of those guys' autographs. It wasn't one of those. I mean, even the Tommy Frazier's, the Brooke Behringer's, the Trev Alberts, the
Rob Zadiskas.
I don't know about that, but I mean the big name players, the Will Shields. You could get all of those autographs if you were willing to stand in line behind 10 other people. It wasn't these 300 person lines.
Yeah, the only thing that creeps me out about fan days are the number of adults that want autographs. That always kind of, you know, bothers me a little bit because I think it's more for the kids than it is adults.
Oh, I mean, if I had a kid who was a huge fan and wanted autographs, I'd have no problem taking them to the
But if you're an adult by yourself going, you're a little weird.
It is, and that's kind of what I meant about the whole autograph thing in general for adults. If I'm asking somebody for an autograph, like I said, with Tom Osborne, it's one of those things. I wanted my kids to have Tom Osborne's autograph. Outside of that, I'm getting it because I get asked for fundraising items all the time, and so I keep a small stash of kind of big-name autograph stuff just so when somebody asks me for something, I don't have to go get something. I've got a closet of stuff. I go to the closet and, all right, here's a Dave Remington autograph. That's a big seller. Here's a Tom Osborne autograph. That's a big seller. I've got that stuff already, so I can just hand it out to various charities.
So enough about autographs because that's taking place on Thursday. Then, you know, practice kicks in and reality sets in, and then it's a month of solid work and preparing for that first game. My question to you is this. How much playing time can be earned in the fall now? And let me finish where I'm going with this. With spring football, with summer conditioning, with the amount of data and analytics that coaches use right now, is playing time predetermined, or is there still no substitute for getting on the field and performing? And can actual
I think it's the latter.
Really?
It really, truly is. And I guess the example I give is, You can look at, there's a number of places on that roster right now that I think they would have liked to have had it set at spring ball that aren't set. I mean, you look at that center position, the left guard position. I mean, is Trent Hickson going to be the guy that people think he could be? Or is it going to be, dude, is it going to be the younger of the two Farniok brothers on the offensive line currently? Is Juergens going to be healthy enough to start at center? Are you going to have to... Are you going to maybe have to move Hickson over to center? I mean, there's a lot of questions in playing time and starting spots still yet to be pounded out. Now, here's the other thing, too. When I played, it wasn't as big of a factor, but in this day and age it is. Is those true freshmen coming in? Now, you had the early enrollee guys who did go through spring football, but you've got a lot of young guys, a lot of these true freshmen who maybe have been working out with the team over the summer, but they didn't enroll early, so they weren't there at spring football practice, who truly have a chance to kind of make some noise. And it may not be from a starting standpoint, but it might be from a major contributor standpoint, say like what Mo Washington did last year. So there's a lot of room for these guys to come in and shake up roster spots. So I truly think it's the latter. I know there's a lot of evaluation, but with a coach like Frost, where physical conditioning, size, speed, and strength development, that overall development plays a massive, massive role in how they evaluate these guys. And at the same time, this is still just year two. So there's a lot of development in terms of just being able to understand and have a confidence in your ability, whether you're a tight end, an offensive guard, Martinez at quarterback, whatever, to be able to run these plays and fully understand that offense. So that whole developmental picture, when it's only year two of a new system, you're still learning a lot in a very short amount of time. And so percentage-wise, in terms of the total amount of practice, the total amount of experience that these players have with that system, this fall practice is still a fairly sizable percentage of that developmental timeline.
And it's also a chance to build depth, which most teams want to do. And this is where I want to ask about, you know, getting the eyeball test. Do you get a better look? Because some people don't want their rosters at 150. And I was reading an article earlier this week, and Scott Frost says, you know, he's trying to, with the model that Tom Osborne
they're
used.
They're now, what, 160 yeah. some, I thought.
But he's trying to get it to where everybody practiced. And that's what he was trying to say, that when you played.
And that's how we did it. I mean, I remember first fall camp as a true freshman, we had 180 guys.
So my question is, can you get, even though everybody practices, with that many more people, do you actually get a better look at developing guys as opposed to 105?
Oh, so much better.
And explain how that works.
So, you know, the model is, there's kind of two modes of thinking. I call it the NFL model because it's one that it kind of has gotten standardized within the NFL, and it's how a lot of NFL coaches think. And that's basically the starters and maybe a select few backups get all the repetitions in practice. So the 11 guys on offense, and maybe there's a one or two swing offensive linemen, there's a third tight end, there's a second running back. Those guys get all the reps on offense. Maybe there's a third defensive tackle, a third defensive end, a fourth and a fifth linebacker, the nickel and dime defensive backs in addition to the starting four. But beyond those guys, everybody else is either A, holding a blocking dummy on the other side of the ball, or they're watching. And that's the NFL model. Starters get all the practice reps. I say all, 90-95% of them. Tom Osborne's model, the way he did it, was he would set up a first-string offense and a second-string offense. First-string offense was always kind of what I had mentioned before. You kind of had probably 7 offensive linemen, two running backs, 2 fullbacks, 3 tight ends, 2 quarterbacks, probably at least 4 wide receivers, maybe 5. Second string offense was another 6 or 7 offensive linemen, another 2 fullbacks, another 2 or 3 running backs, another 2 quarterbacks, another 5 wide receivers. And so when you start looking at those numbers, all of a sudden on your first string and second string offense that are getting all the reps in practice, there's 13 or 14 offensive linemen. At least 2 or 3 of those guys are swing guys who can play center and guard and tackle, so on and so forth. You've got at least 4 tight ends, 3 or 4 fullbacks, 4 or 5 running backs, 3 or 4 quarterbacks, 10 wide receivers, 8 to 10 wide receivers, that are of guys that are consistently getting practice snaps. Now, they're also practicing against 2 separate defensive scout teams, mostly true freshmen, a few true sophomores, tons of red shirts. Guess what those guys are doing? You've got a bunch of defensive scout team guys who are going against a group of really good, well-seasoned, well-developed offensive football players. That makes those guys better because they're getting tons and tons of repetitions. They're getting practice snaps against first-string and second-string guys. And you reverse that on defense. You got the defense going against scout team offense. Well, if you're an offensive tackle, I'm going to use myself for instance. I have to go out there every day in practice my entire redshirt year, and I'm going to butt heads with Kenny Walker and Mike Kroll, a top 5 NFL draft pick, and another guy in Kenny Walker who is arguably the best athlete I have ever played or practiced against, who is, an NFL draft pick. I had to spend my entire freshman year, my entire redshirt year, going against those 2 guys. Periodically had to go against Joe Sims and Jamie Lever and Kevin Raymakers and John Perrell. I mean, it was just this constant barrage of incredibly talented, incredibly athletic, NFL-caliber guys every single play of every practice for an entire season. That's a lot of really good practice repetition for a kid to get. And you get that kind of practice. They expected us to give these guys a look. This was not a, hey, we won't take it easy on these guys, just kind of hold a spot down so they know where the offense is lining up. They truly expected us to go out and try and block these guys. And so when you're a true freshman redshirt trying to block Kenny Walker play after play after play, try and pass block against Mike Kroll, guy who is a Pro Bowler for the Denver Broncos. Are you kidding me? I mean, that's brutal.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, you fast forward a year, and now I'm a redshirt freshman. You think I'm going to see anything better than that? I mean, there's a few. We played Miami in the Orange Bowl, and I got to go against Rusty Medeiros and Jesse Armstead. Those guys are pretty damn good. But it's when that's the kind of situation that's happening, there's a mass amount of development, not only amongst the first and string players that are getting – you got 2 to 3 deep at each position getting a ton of reps at practice. You also have all these true freshmen, true sophomores, all these redshirts, these walk-ons who are getting – I mean, you can't put a value on the practice repetitions that these guys are getting against – starting Big Ten football players. That is huge, the amount of develop that creates.
So as you look at the start of fall camp, high level, we know quarterbacks taken. Where do you think there is playing time to be earned right now?
I think on the offensive line, and I think this is a spot that's been an incredibly thin position for the last, honestly, the last decade. Austin now is in a position where he could comfortably have 10 guys that could play. And that's something we haven't seen for quite some time. Absolute testament to some of it's to recruiting. A lot of it's just a player development. I mean, physical development with Duvall and his staff, and a massive, massive amount of it's to Greg Austin's coaching. But I think that's a spot where you're going to see that development finally coming up, just from a pure depth standpoint. The defensive line is another spot where I think you've got some guys again that have developed, and you finally got a little bit of depth there. You can lose a defensive tackle and it's not going to kill you, and that would have been the case in past years. Running back is the one spot. I'm still worried about it. I think Mills is a great addition. But, it would be nice to know that a guy like Maurice Washington's going to be available. And it increasingly looks like he's not going to be. So that's something I worry about, is that running back spot. Because you don't have a Divine Azigbo. Although, last year at this point going into the season, That was considered the weak point of the team, and by the time the season ended, running back was arguably one of the strengths of that team.
Yeah, very, very much so. You mentioned Maurice Washington. Don't you think, in today's day and age, that's just a PR issue he doesn't need to deal with right now, isn't it?
Well,
right or wrong,
you've got multiple PR issues. Yes. Now you're talking about the whole video thing. Yes. In the car, are you talking about the marijuana or all of it?
All of it.
Yeah, it's there's a little bit of play stupid games, win stupid prizes going on there. And most people I've talked with who know him personally say he's a good kid. I just, there's some stuff you just don't do. And it's the kind of thing that in this, we keep using this phrase, in this day and age,
we're woke now, Rob. We're woke.
Woke. But in this day and age, I mean, we used to crack jokes about how we needed to get our kids to program the VCR. Man, these guys grew up in the age of cell phones and cell phone cameras and videos. And you don't do anything without it being on tape somewhere. And these guys, the fact that they still make stupid decisions like this without expecting it to come back and haunt them, this is the kind of thing that it's just, there ought to be a mantra or a hashtag of, just don't hit the send button.
I just watched The Great Hack on Netflix, and I will tell you right now, anything you do online, and I've accepted this a long time ago, I realize that I'm being watched.
Oh,
yeah,
totally.
And so if you don't realize that now, then you're stupid.
Oh, I get, you know, I gave it up a long time ago because I know a number of guys who they're scared of.
You can't go off the grid. If you have a credit card, you're not off the grid.
Yeah.
If you pay a bill, you're not off the grid.
There's a number of people I work with. So in a hospital, we use a lot of the biometric pass coding. I mean, you use your fingerprint to get into like the little pharmacy facilities, I need such and such drug for this patient. You go to an automated pharmacy machine that has the medications in it. You use your fingerprint to do it. I know a number of people who sit there and go, I don't want my fingerprint floating around the ether. I'm still going to use my username and password to log in. I'm not going to use my fingerprint. And I'm sitting here going, okay, every single one of us, if you've got a DEA license, if you have a medical license, you've been fingerprinted left and right. The state patrol has a set of your fingerprints. The federal government has a set of your fingerprints. Your photo is everywhere. Facial recognition. You know what? I have had to, for licensing and relicensing purposes, the number of times I've had to send in a passport photo, a set of my fingerprints, all of that stuff. They are, oh my gosh, they've got everything they want on me and everybody else.
And these are the same people who go, hey, I just got my 23andMe results back. I'm 85% Hungarian. Well, guess what? You're in a DNA database now.
Yeah, guess who knows that? Like half the health insurance industry now knows is going to buy that info from somebody.
Taking another time out for Ticket Talk, brought to you by Ticket Express, joined once again by the King Ticketmaster himself. I shouldn't use the word Ticketmaster because that's conflicting. Let's say the King Ticket Express man. Should we say that, Chad?
Yeah.
Chad Carr from Ticket Express. How you doing today, buddy?
Never better. I've been called a lot worse than that, Travis, so it's all good.
And I didn't mean to screw up those branding things there, you know. It's just, but this is, you know, a live interview, and we don't edit by any means. We don't change things. But as we kick off Ticket Talk for week number two, you got a pretty cool promotion you want to talk about.
You bet. This is going to be the second year that we have done this. So what we are doing is we are partnering up with a company called SEA Promotions, and we're running a promotion for anybody who buys tickets for any home or road regular season Nebraska game between now and August the 9th. So Friday, August 9th. If Nebraska goes on and wins the Big Ten championship game in Indianapolis in December, so they have to qualify for the game and then win it, then your purchase is refunded 100% for that regular season game that you bought via Ticket Express.
See, that's super cool, but man, that's a risk by you because Nebraska's picked to win the West, and if they do that, who knows what happens in Indianapolis?
Absolutely. And, you know, that's kind of why we've partnered up with this company for the second year in a row. We've been working with them over the past 5 years, and we just feel that this is kind of a neat way to get people to order tickets directly from Ticket Express and kind of reward some of our loyal customers over the past 26 years.
All right, so I got a question. So if I go purchase now between now and August 9th, I'm in this promotion. What if I purchased a ticket in July, like say July 1?
Great question. So we are not going to punish people that ordered tickets early. All of those orders are going to be grandfathered in. So basically, if you order tickets anytime in 2019 for any one of the qualifying games, which is any Nebraska home or road game, regular season game, you're automatically entered into the promotion.
See, that's a great deal. And that's why we do Ticket Talk, because without Ticket Talk, you wouldn't know about great deals like this. And that's been Chad Carr with Ticket Talk, brought to you by Ticket Express. If you went in on this deal, go to TicketExpress.com. That's TicketExpress.com. And Chad, because I have bad memory, you want to give the phone number?
402-398-1999.
All right, I introduced Rob to something pretty cool this weekend, and if you know me, I'm notoriously cheap. I don't like to spend a lot of money. I like to get things for free.
You?
Yeah, and you're cheap too.
Not as bad as you.
No, I'm pretty cheap.
But I haven't passed a hat at a party yet.
But the internet blew up last week over Nebraska and Iowa again, and that's a subject I like to talk about because, well, it's no secret. I'm an Iowa fan. You are the former Nebraska player and Nebraska
Iowa
fan.
And Iowa sucks ass.
Come on now. But it came down to the rivalry. And The Athletic, which is a sports site full of great content, had this article by Scott Docterman. And I started
Burlington,
reading it.
Burlington, Iowa native.
And
that's where my mom's from, by the way.
And I'm going to be in Burlington next week, I believe. I'm going to hit an Amtrak out of Burlington.
Nice.
Yes. So I started reading. I'm like, oh, I want this. I got to keep reading it. So I went ahead and just purchased a year of The Athletic. And from the minute I read the first story, I had zero regrets. And I said, hey, check out The Athletic. And you're like, hey, give me your password so I don't have to pay.
Okay, that was pretty cheap. I will give you that.
And so I said, hey, there's a 7-day free trial. And you texted me like 2 hours later going, dude, this is the greatest thing ever. I mean, newspapers should be worried. And nothing against my fellow newspaper friends.
They are worried.
Nothing against my newspaper friends. But if you have not subscribed to The Athletic yet, and I don't like paying for content. I don't, because I believe in free content. But this is worth the $4 a month that you have to pay.
Yeah, but if you want good content, I'd be the first to tell you, these are guys working. I mean,
yes, absolutely.
These are guys trying to earn a living.
Yes.
Doing sports journalism.
This is, it's a different type of writing, though, don't you think, Rob?
Oh, my God, it's so good. Well, and there's a lot of people, when you start looking at, I mean, I hate to say this, World Herald's has had some really good writers over the years. I'm disappointed because one of my favorites is Matt Hansen.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the writing that he and his wife have done for the World Herald, it's great stuff. They do these incredibly in-depth, incredibly well-researched stories. I think Hansen was one of the guys who, it was some of his research and writing that led to a change in the identification of the flag raisers at Iwo Jima.
This is the
quality of stuff that some of these writers are capable of.
But I think what The Athletic does,
The Athletic is basically the sports version of that.
So the reason this Iowa-Nebraska rivalry story came about by Scott Docterman is that they are doing a large series on realignment. And I'm telling you, whether you like the Pac-12, the SEC, the Big 12, the Big 10, the ACC, these are unbelievable reads. Part of the Big 10 realignment story was the Nebraska-Iowa budding rivalry. And Nebraskans got all pissed off, all bent out of shape, saying, we're not a rival of Iowa. And I didn't quite get that. And I had Scott Docterman on my radio show, which you can hear daily on iHeartRadio at 1460 KXNO, talk about this. And he did a lot of interviews. And here's kind of his breakdown of why there may be some pushback from Nebraskans.
It's such an odd mix between Iowa and Nebraska.
It is.
Fans because they just have different outlooks and histories, obviously. And, you know, I kind of, you know, to go the lowest common denominator, I kind of go, well, it's self-righteousness versus insecurity. But, you know, but the fact is, you know, these are two very proud fan bases that, you know, really enjoy their programs. And, you know, Nebraska's point of view, I don't think they want to be rivals with Iowa. They look at Iowa as down from kind of the way it did in the Big Eight with Colorado or Missouri or Kansas State when Bill Snyder was building it, whereas Iowa kind of looks at it and goes, you know what, we already have three great rivalries.
Yeah.
Iowa State, certainly. Minnesota's the oldest one. Wisconsin's a great rivalry. Why do we need you to be our rival if you won't accept us? Which really means that there's enough contempt on both sides, and it comes out in full force every time you write something like this.
Thoughts on what he just said? I love self-righteousness against insecurity.
Do you know what I liked what he said?
What?
Contempt. Because I guarantee you, excuse me, Iowa fans want to think that Iowa and Iowa State hate each other. I don't know.
It's getting more that way because Iowa State's better.
They do. There's a little bit, but I think there's kind of a, you know what, We're all buying the same Busch Light. It's we're all native Iowans. There we go. It's fine. I think there's a lot of respect between Iowa and Minnesota from a historical
standpoint.
There's a lot of historical respect between Iowa and Wisconsin, and actually, because that's for the last 4 or 5 years, that's kind of been the one game that truthfully has really kind of been the linchpin of who's going to win the West Division has been the Iowa-Wisconsin game. This is going to be the contempt game. It's going to be the hate game. It's going to be the two schools that, you know what, we just need somebody to hate. We need somebody to dislike. We need somebody to yell at. We need somebody to look down upon. And you know what, Doctorman's article was great because one of the things he talked about, these are the people you see in the supermarket. You walk into Hy-Vee, the Hy-Vee I shop at sells Husker and Hawkeye gear. It's... You see Hawkeye fans. I've got a...
Well, the Omaha Council Bluffs area is the second or third largest University of Iowa alumni group there is.
It is. There are a lot of Iowa fans in this region.
But you brought up this year's game. Nebraska picked to win the West. Iowa picked to finish second. I've said before, this could go down to the last game of the year, winner take all.
Now, keep in mind, too... Both teams received 14 first place votes. I mean, it's pretty much, I mean, it's a draw between the two. I mean, Nebraska, I get it. They got more second and third place votes. So technically they had more overall points in the poll. But essentially it was split dead down the center as to who was going to win it.
And Doctorman, I talked about that with Scott, about this coming down to the last game of the season. I think he summed up the series so far of why this year could actually make it a rivalry.
In order for it to reach, you know, a certain level, there has to be some pain inflicted and there has to be something that matters. And in the 8 years that they've played one another on Black Friday, Nebraska won the Legends Division in 2012, but Iowa was 4-8. And then in 2015, Iowa cemented an unbeaten regular season, but Nebraska was 5-7. So, you know, there has to be a winner-take-all game. There has to be a game where one team's going to win the division and the other team knocks it off. Or you know, you're playing when you're both ranked for something at stake. And there just hasn't been that moment yet.
Totally agree with him on that.
Well, and that was sort of the underlying theme of the whole Nebraska-Oklahoma rivalry, which I'd be the first to admit. I met a lot of University of Oklahoma guys after I left Nebraska, and in the short amount of time I was in the NFL, I got to meet a lot of Oklahoma guys. All of the OU guys that I spoke with, they all said Nebraska was kind of rivalry B. That it was sort of like Texas was rivalry 1A, Oklahoma State was rivalry 1B, and then Nebraska was...
That would upset Nebraska fans. Now,
yeah, but it's true, though. I mean, most Oklahoma considered Texas and Oklahoma State to be the big two rivals. They had a lot of respect for that Nebraska game. But the reason that Nebraska-Oklahoma game was a big deal, rivalry or not in Sooner fans and Sooner players' minds, the reason it was a big deal is because, man, 8 out of 10 years, 9 out of 10 years – from kind of the early mid-60s through the really early 90s. Colorado kind of came in there as well, late 80s and early 90s. But 8 out of 10 years, the Big 8 title came down to the Nebraska-Oklahoma game.
It's funny because Rob and I did not really talk about – when we sit down to record, we really just kind of sit down and record and we have a conversation. We don't pre-script anything. We just start
Infusion
asking.
Infusion helps.
Yeah, it really does. But you bring up a very good point with your Oklahoma analogy, and I've said this all before, which I don't get Nebraska fans here, is that a rival does not have to be singular. It can be plural. You can have more than one rivalry. And I asked Scott Doctorman about that on my show on 1460 KXNO.
You know, Nebraska's historical rival is Oklahoma. We know that. But,
yep.
But Oklahoma had even three at that point. Oklahoma State and Bedlam and then Texas.
Yep.
Even when it was a non-conference game, it was a big rivalry.
Yep.
And it certainly is now. So it's not like it has to be exclusive. And part of that, I think, for Nebraska is that they've never had anybody locally that you could kind of put in their same, you know, it was even status. There's no in-state team. And,
yep.
And you know, when you look throughout the Big Ten, I mean, Michigan's main rival is Ohio State, but, you know, Michigan State is a big rival for it, too. And Ohio State has the same thing going with Penn State. And so it doesn't have to be exclusive. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, kind of is perplexing to me is, like, it's not just Iowa. I mean, and if you're going to target Iowa fans on who is their biggest rival, it really kind of depends on geography. I mean, every day if you're in Des Moines and you rub elbows with Iowa State fans, it's easily Iowa State. On the eastern side, it's probably mixed. It's probably, it depends on the day. And then in the western Iowa, it's got to be Nebraska. So it doesn't have to be exclusive. And I think that's one thing that Nebraska fans have to come around to, because it's just, it's a different world now that, you know, that people aren't catering to you the way they once did.
I think Nebraska fans are still reacting to Tom Osborne. And Tom Osborne was asked about this all the time, about the rivalry games. And he'd always say, we don't have a rival.
Which we rarely did. I mean, I think Oklahoma truly, it was the closest thing Nebraska had for the better part mm-hmm. of the Devaney-Osborne era. I think Nebraskans have wanted a rival. I'd be the first to tell you, I would love to have that team. Like, oh, I freaking hate these guys. I can't wait for the game.
Is Iowa there for you yet?
For me, yeah.
That's good. But it makes this podcast a lot more fun.
It does, but here's the thing. I think when Nebraska fans get pissed off and go like, they're not a rival. They don't measure up. They're not a rival. The moment you're getting upset
about
it being called a rivalry, that means you do not like these guys. Because guess what? Do you know what you hear Nebraska fans not bitching and moan about? Purdue. You don't hear anybody complaining about Illinois. Nobody gives a rat's ass about Maryland.
No, or Rutgers.
Or exactly. I mean, it's,
and over time,
and even Wisconsin, we'd love to beat Wisconsin.
But
I guarantee you, if you ask most Nebraska fans, hey, Iowa or Wisconsin, pig, you got to beat one. Who do you want to win? I guarantee you, 9 out of 10 people are going to say Iowa, because it's one of those, yeah, there's these two people I work with, and they're both Iowa fans, and you know what? Screw those sons.
And here's the genius of that realignment series on The Athletic, and I think it kind of touches upon this. I think Nebraska fans literally thought when they went into the Big Ten, they were going to be on the same playing field as Ohio State and Michigan, that they were held in that regard, and it just hasn't lived up to that.
No, it hasn't. I mean,
now, that's the reality. That's, I'm not being a dick here.
Yeah, that's Nebraska's problem. But
yeah,
but I mean, if you even go back to the Big 12 days, the moment the Big 12 started and Nebraska didn't play Oklahoma every single year, and the moment that the Nebraska-Oklahoma game was not the deciding factor as to who was going to win the conference, all of a sudden, people kind of stopped caring quite a little bit about that rivalry aspect. You really wanted to beat Oklahoma, but winning that conference title was the big thing. And I think about when I was down in Lincoln, Oklahoma was still a top 25 team most of the time I was in Lincoln. I think the one time Oklahoma fell out of the top 25 of the 4 years that I played, 91 through 94, was when we beat them in the regular season finale at the end of the 94 season. It actually dropped Oklahoma to, I think, 6-5 and knocked them out of the top 25.
Was that Gary Gibbs last year?
You know, I believe it was.
Yeah.
So that was – Oklahoma was still a very good team then. But Colorado was a much better team.
And Kansas State was getting a lot better at that point.
K-State was getting a lot better.
Well, hell, you're seeing it. I mean, Chad May and that group was a good football team.
Stellar defense. Great defenses. Chad May was good. They had a very good – you had Barrett Brooks at offensive tackle. They had a very solid offensive line. Quentin Newyear at center.
So make it official right now. I want you to say Iowa is a rival.
Oh, it is. I said that like 5 minutes ago.
I know, but I just wanted to get it down.
My point is, though, is that as much as Nebraska fans want to think of Oklahoma as their traditional rival, man, even by 92, 93, 94, the game that probably truly decided the Big 8 title was who won the Nebraska-Colorado game. Now, I will still say 91, which was my redshirt freshman year, Big 8 title came down to the Nebraska-Oklahoma game at the end of the year, which if Nebraska wins, Nebraska wins the Big 8 title. If Oklahoma wins, Colorado wins the Big 8 title. So it was a conference deciding game, conference title deciding game. But for most of the early by the early 90s, the conference title was going to come down between Nebraska and Colorado, actually. And so by then, you were already losing that luster a little bit. You had to beat Oklahoma not to keep Oklahoma from winning the conference title. You had to beat Oklahoma to keep Colorado from winning the conference title. And so by then, as much as I think it absolutely galls Nebraska fans, Tom Osborne traditionalists, the big rivalry, even by 91 and onward, was probably Colorado.
You know, I think this should make Nebraska fans feel good. I did a poll on my radio show, and I said, hey, of the four teams that left the Big 12 Conference, Missouri, Nebraska, Colorado, Texas A&M, what team, and this would be more of an Iowa State vote than anything, what team would you want back in the Big 12? And Nebraska won that vote. It was close. It was close between Nebraska and Missouri, which made me happy because I think those two teams are geographically, for Iowa people, I think they're bordering states. So
it's the best fit. I mean, it's the whole realignment thing is such an interesting question because it opens. I mean, if you get a chance, the series of articles they have, Stuart Mandel's article is great.
So go to huskerdoctalk.podbean.com, and I'll have a link to where you can just subscribe right there. Just click it. You'll be able to subscribe, and that'd be great. I mean, it'd be the seven-day trial.
You realize the more people that sign up for The Athletic, the more nails in the coffin that are going into the World Herald and Journal Stars.
Well, you look at the people dropping out of the World Herald now. I think the coffin's halfway down six feet.
It is, but you look at the guys going to write for The Athletic.
Well, Mitch Sherman, who used to be at the World Herald, went to ESPN.com, and maybe we try to get Mitch on the podcast. I don't know if he'd be willing to come on the podcast. He can come up and sit with us. But Mitch Sherman is The Athletic beat writer for Nebraska.
And it is, and that's the thing, is that you've got these I don't know, what do you call it, a website?
It's just a website. I mean,
it is. You've got a website like The Athletic. They've got they've got regional guys. They've got local guys. They have beat writers. You're going to get that same content. I hate shooting down the World Herald because, man, I got guys I went to high school with who write for the World Herald.
Here's the problem where it's going against is that, you know, the World Herald has to go to an editor and say, hey, I'm going to do this, blah, blah, blah. You're cut on size and time. These web guys, who they're in charge of their team, they can write whatever they want to write about and then go as long as they want to go.
The content's awesome.
It is so awesome.
Is very
just
good.
Not at a local level, but also a national level, which is super, super cool. And you can just click the link on our website, huskerdoctalk.podbean.com. Of course, you can find the Husker Doc Talk podcast on Podbean, on iTunes, on Google Play Music, on Stitcher, and also great podcast websites out there all around. What we want you to do is give us a review. So give us a 1-star, 2-star, 3-star, 4-star, or if you know, Dr. Rob's a 5-star. And also write something, because the way we can grow this podcast, get more people interested in it, especially from a college football level, is to have people like it and write a review about us and tell us what you think of us. If you don't like us, that's fine too. But we would love any kind of review or rating that you could give us, and that's very much appreciated.
Give us the loose morals rating.
That's right. And if you want to do it just face-to-face, well, you can't come face-to-face with us, but
We record a few times a year up there.
Yeah, I think we're going to do a preseason one at Infusion, so that'd be the week before the first game.
Yeah, we always do a season wrap up out there.
And you can email us doctalksports@gmail.com.
Chili cook-off appearance.
That's right. I forgot about that. That was really good.
Not only is it
Now you're making me hungry, dude.
Not only is it great beer, it's delicious, too.
It's very, very delicious. For Dr. Rob Zadiska, I'm Travis Justice. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of the Husker Doc Talk Podcast, presented by the Remington Trophy.